The idea of an emerging artist is really somewhat of a misnomer. We are all constantly emerging from the second we arrive. We're emerging away from where we've been and into the next phase of who we're about to be. And yet for some people, it can feel like it takes a lifetime just to get born. All you can do is just keep showing up and hope that this time somebody will take some notice. For Jacob Jeffries, the journey to becoming an emerging artist has taken nearly 20 years. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. Jacob Jeffries has been making records since he was a teenager in South Florida. He signed his first publishing deal at age 18, and he made a flurry of early recordings. But only now, after two decades of persistence, loss, and reinvention, does it feel like maybe his moment is arriving. Jeffries grew up in a Beatles house. He was that kid who wore a Fab Four t-shirt to school every day. His summers were spent at Lovewell, a theater program where students and staff created original musicals together. That was his early education in the power of collaboration, something that would go on to serve him very well. As a young artist, he was taken under the wing of Grammy-winning producer Sebastian Criss and guitarist Dan Warner, who shepherded him into the studio and helped him to navigate his first deals. On paper, that looked like a fast track to stardom, but life intervened. Jeffries lost his father suddenly when he was 19, and then his mother to cancer just a few years later. Those twin tragedies left him and his sister to find their own paths. Hers through the stability of family and becoming a nurse, his through the itinerant world of music. Grief became a shadow and a motivator, something to process and honor through songs. What makes Jeffries unusual is how he channels that history. On stage with the band Wolfpack, he is pure energy and absurdist humor, dancing, singing, mugging for the crowd. A surrealist performance artist in the middle of one of the most musically adept and conceptually playful bands of the era. When Wolfpack played at Madison Square Garden last month, Jeffries was as likely to be found doing shtick, what he calls miping around, as he was to be delivering a soaring vocal. Although he's a newer member of the band, he embodies the Wolf ethos. No single star, everyone shines, everyone plays. And yet his own music reveals another side entirely. His new record, You Got the Right Idea, produced by fellow Wolfpack bandmate Theo Katzman for Katzman's 10 Good Songs label, is quiet where Wolfpack is raucous, vulnerable where the stage show is winking. The songs are intimate, sometimes even whispered, full of reflection on love, loss, family, and the slow accrual of wisdom. One song confronts a child moving one seat down toward independence. Another imagines his grandparents' love affair in Poland in the early 20th century. Yet another takes a more playful, Beatles-esque detour, reminding listeners not to take it all too seriously. Because in Jeffries' world, sincerity and satire are not opposites, but companions. The high-energy clowning and the hushed confessions both come from the same place. A need to live fully, to honor the weight of experience without being crushed by it. So, ultimately, emerging artist isn't a contradiction after all. Jacob Jeffries has been at it long enough to know what it means to endure, to reinvent, to keep creating. If it feels like he's just getting started, maybe that means he's doing it right. Third-story.com is the place to visit the archive. Hundreds of deep dives like this one, including previous conversations with most of the members of the Wolfpack family. Jack Stratton, Theo Katzman, Joe Dart, Corey Wong, Woody Goss, Antoine Stanley, Tyler Duncan, and many Wolf-adjacent folks too, like Monica Martin, Ella Feingold, Adam Levy, Louis Cato, Nate Smith, Ryan Lerman. So many, really. Check my Substack for the latest writings and episodes too. It's leosidran.substack.com. And remember that we are made in partnership with WBGO Studios. Visit wbgo.org/studios to learn more about all their award-winning content. Here's me and Jacob Jeffries talking it down. Jacob Jeffries, we have a tight hour here because you have a gig in New York tonight. You played at Madison Square Garden last night with Wolfpack. So much to do, so little time. So first of all, I would love a recap of, do you even have enough distance from last night to have impressions of what that was.
Maybe. I think it was obviously a bucket list moment for any performer, anybody that's had a dream since they were a kid to play in front of people. Madison Square Garden is the one. There's pictures of all of the celebrities and athletes and everybody that's been in that in the spotlight there. Backstage, you see Lennon, you see Elton John, you see Bowie, Dr. Dre, Patrick Ewing, everybody. And just that alone makes you kind of sends chills down your spine. And then being there, it's a little overwhelming, but to be honest with you, performing with your best friends on stage, it kind of makes it feel like just any other gig in a way, too. Yeah. You don't need to get overwhelmed when you're in the moment, which is a beautiful thing.
I stood off to the side of the stage when Wolf played it in 2019, and I was kind of struck by realizing that it is just a big room. Like, the stage, when you see what the stage is, they build the stage for the event. It's kind of not a permanent fixture. Mm-hmm. It all felt way more temporary and a little, not rickety, but a little more to scale than I thought it was going to feel.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I was honestly slightly surprised at the size of the stage. Yeah. It is like a, it's just, they are risers.
Yeah, risers.
Just, it's a stage, and a stage is a stage, and some of them are temporary, some of them are concrete amphitheater in parks. But
yeah,
I think what I was talking to our lighting designer this morning at the hotel, Ryan Bress, shout out to one of probably my favorite lighting designer in the world. we were talking about how it felt like a room. It's a room, a room is a room. But there's this cool, I was noticing while I was on stage on the left and right, is this like third tier. There's like a balcony to the balcony. And that felt really sick because I was like looking up. It reminded me of this amphitheater we played in France where you kind of, the people just kind of touch the sky straight ahead and just kind of lifts almost, it looks like it's
vertically straight up.
Yeah, like just this vertical line and people are perched on top. But that felt really cool. Like looking out at the people in the pit, they were all having a blast. And I had friends and family on either side of the seats. But then you can look up at the balcony and it's like, oh man, this is actually an arena. And I'm just so grateful to be a part of the Wolf Peck project and writing process and performance. It's just such a beautiful group of people. And what an honor.
Yeah.
Like to be an MSG.
It's crazy. It's amazing. And then it's funny that you, not at all surprising to me in any way, wrote to me at 2 a.m. You were like, hey, maybe we'll do it a little later tomorrow than I thought. Because it's hard enough to come down from a show.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you played MSG and you also have to steady yourself for an extra gig tonight.
I'm playing tonight my own stuff. But my brain was hard to shut off last night. I got to, you know, full transparency. I'm giving it my all when I need to. But I'm not on stage the entire show. I'm not playing drums the whole night. I'm not Joe Dart on the bass, you know. I mean, these guys are all putting in.
That's
like,
true.
These guys are going four quarters of, you know, of how do I keep this PG? They're
no,
just
you,
going.
You don't have to be PG.
Oh, well, yeah. I was just going to say balls to the wall. Yep. But I don't like saying that, but I'm going to say it.
Yeah. That's you could good. Say balls to the wall.
Okay.
If you
yeah. Well, these guys are going hard. Yeah. And I like to give it my all when I'm asked to sing or dance around. We call it miping around when I can mipe.
What does mipe mean?
It's a term derived on the last Wolf tour in Amsterdam. We just kind of mipe around. It's when you just hang out.
Well, my first impression of you was as somebody who goes all in. I mean, I think the first thing I saw you do was maybe I'm nice to you with Jack.
Yeah. I'm nice to you. I'm nice to you. I try for you. I die for you. I'm nice to you, but you're just not into me. I'm nice to you, I try for you, I'd die for you. I'm nice to you, but you're just not into me.
Because you are a newer member of the Wolf family. Now it's been a number of years, but like I think that was during the reset, the sort of COVID reset. Around then, it seemed like, is when I first saw you.
Yeah.
In 2021 or around then. I'm not sure exactly when
I can't remember what year. Yeah, it sounds right because it was Schwitz came after that, right?
Yeah, I think so,
It was like the first since then.
Yeah.
That makes sense. I mean, I was a Wolf Peck fan for quite some time.
Yeah.
Maybe not the first wave, but I hopped on when I found Theo's record and Wolf at the same time. Heartbreak Hits was I blasted that in my 15-passenger van that I used as a daily commuter because I wasn't touring anymore. I was just like, okay, I'm stuck with this van. I guess I'm driving it to the dentist, you know? And so I'm blasting Theo's record all over LA when I first moved there. And then I discovered Wolf and I'm like anxiously awaiting their next YouTube video because I love these guys. I become close with Theo. We start, you know, showing each other songs and I start playing keys with Theo. And I guess I didn't think I'd be part of the Wolfpack band off the bat. But once I started meeting everyone from the band, I was like, oh, these people I feel like I've known my whole life. And I feel like these are like
family.
These are like family friends.
Are you the same age?
We're all like the same age.
Yeah.
Theo and I discovered early on that we have had very similar like music journeys. We both lived in New York and played Rockwood Music Hall all the time and like shared band members without even knowing
it.
Like, yeah, like he had this drummer that he used that I used. And I think it was like, and then we both like broke up with our girlfriends around the same time without knowing it and then moved to LA at the same time without knowing it. Yeah, it was like this like, whoa, maybe we were supposed to meet and commiserate.
You also, this is a fast time to bring this up, but you also both lost your dads young.
Yeah, we did. I'm not sure exactly how old Theo was, but I know he was. It was not easy to. It's never easy to lose your father. In your, I think he was in his early 20s.
Yeah.
I was around then. I was about 19 years old when my dad suddenly passed one day. And I mean, if Theo is a hard on his sleeve guy, as you know, and we've had deep conversations about grief and trying to transition from moments of grief to moments of productivity and art and making things in their honor because, Theo and I aren't the same person. We have different relationships with our fathers, but I can speak to mine and say that, like, all my dad really wanted was for me to be a musician professionally.
Really?
And yeah, both parents were so supportive, you know? I was never faced with this need to rebel and be like, they don't want me to play music. I'm going to play music. I'm turning it up to 11 and cranking. But like they bought me the piano.
Yeah.
They were like, go practice. They were like, go play. Go write a song, you know? So this is what they always wanted me to do. And I think they'd be so happy that I found a family like Wolf to be able to
totally
hang out with.
That's interesting. You know, you talk about Theo being hard on his sleeve. I feel that way too. Stratton is a more conceptual lyricist, you know, a meta lyricist, somebody who writes about the thing he's writing about. And you, as far as I can tell, are the, like, sit squarely in between those two.
Yeah, I feel that way too. I feel like we, the three of us, Theo, Jack, and I, have a cool bond where it does feel, it's kind of Three Stooges vibes, you know? I don't know. It's all very complimentary.
Yeah.
No one in the band, for that matter, has the ego doesn't get in the way at all. If there is an ego flare up or something, it never shows its head or its ugly face. You know, it's like everybody's relationship feels complimentary to each other.
It's a multi-pronged, multi-headed beast, right? I mean, there's so many characters and personalities in this project.
Yeah. I'm just grateful. Again, I can't say it enough. I'm just like so happy and thankful. We're all working musicians.
Yeah.
You know, we all do different things. We've all played hellish gigs of load-ins and lugging. I used to lug my keyboard through a hotel kitchen to play for like 5 hours at the lobby of a hotel in Miami Beach for like $200.
Yeah.
It's like we've all been in the trenches.
Yeah.
And so I'm just grateful that and we still do. I still do things that I don't want to do. You know, we all do gigs to make our dreams come true. And
yeah.
I'm just grateful that these guys have, like, you know, welcomed me on board. And, no one is the star. That's the thing. You know, MSG last night felt so raw and real, and it could have been any venue USA, to be honest, because you're with a cast of characters in a production. It's much like Broadway or a theatrical thing where it's like, there's actually no lead here. Yeah. Like, we're all just kind of like supporting each other and having fun on stage together.
The project began long before the cultural and political moment that we're in now.
Yeah.
But there is something so reassuring about seeing people collaborating and enjoying themselves in a space that
allows for everybody to shine and nobody has to sort of like be the leader. Nobody has to take all the credit. An audience is capable of valuing and celebrating everybody individually. Mm. Like even if you say, well, it's really Jack's thing or it's real, but or really the original core, the Michigan core or right. the this or the that, like it does. But that's not, I don't feel that's how the audience is. I think the audience wants to love all of it and celebrate all of it.
I think that's some then to now stuff yeah. or like some top down vibration that the original four, yeah. the core four yeah. From Michigan, they've set in place with an ethos of following feeling and following vibe. And I think the audience is a reflection of that.
Yeah.
It's acceptance. Yeah, it's acceptance. It's like a choose your character in the main screen of a video game or something.
Right.
It's like, who do you want to follow this for this song? Like you want to, like you can like someone more than the other. I mean, naturally that's what humans do is they like gravitate
yeah,
towards
their favorite
opinion. Yeah. So it's like, Antoine's going to shine in this moment. Yeah. He's going to sing his butt off. And it's like, oh my God, that's amazing. And then the next song, like it's just a Dart feature. Yeah. And then it's a Corey song. Yeah. And then it's a Jacob thing. And then, oh my God, this solo by Woody. And it's like, you're allowed to pick your favorite, but like every song's going to throw you a curveball, you know? And that's the cool part.
So you grew up in Florida.
Mm-hmm. I was in South Florida, Fort Lauderdale. Weston was the new town at the time. And it was kind of like butting up against the Everglades. We saw alligators on the way to school kind of thing. It was swampy and cool.
Jewish?
Jewish. Not really raised religiously at all, but both parents, Jewish, never really went to temple, was jealous of all the other kids having bar mitzvahs, begged my parents for one.
They said no?
Well, what's funny is they said you should have stayed in Hebrew school. You're the one that wanted to quit Hebrew school. Yeah. I had this thought when I was 8 or 9 when they put me in Hebrew school.
Yeah.
I had a thought that I'm already learning Spanish. There's a lot of Spanish speaking in South Florida.
True.
And I was learning from friends and teachers. And I was like, Spanish is already something I'm trying to tackle as an 8-year-old.
Yeah.
English is also something I'm trying to tackle as an 8-year-old. Yeah. Why are you making me learn Hebrew on Wednesdays at 4 o'clock or whatever?
Yeah, totally.
And they were like, well, this is part of, you know, the thing it's your track to.
Yeah.
To a bar mitzvah. Don't you want that? I was like, no, I don't care.
Yeah.
Fast forward 4 years, all my friends are getting bar mitzvah, and I'm like, oh, they're the center of attention.
They make money.
They're getting $6,000 from friends and family. Yeah. Yeah. I'm like, Mom, Dad, I need a bar mitzvah now. Yeah. And they're like, dude, you're the one that quit Hebrew school. We told you not to. Anyways.
To raise an interesting question, I can tell you as a parent, it's an interesting question, which is, when do you listen to your kid and when do you assert your authority or know better or say, trust me, you'll thank me later?
It's a hard, I mean, I am not one. However, I'm around children. I have a 8-year-old niece and 9-year-old best friend's kid that lives around the block from me and my godson. And anyways, I'm near these kids so much and I'm watching parents parent and I'm also having to parent a little bit myself. And it is hard to know, you want to let the kid be a human and make a decision. And I think that's where my mom and dad were like, all right, he doesn't want to do it. Mm-hmm. He's not going to do it.
Yep.
And then, long form answer to Jewish question mark is yes, but we really never, I went to temple twice maybe, and then a bunch of bar mitzvahs for friends and stuff.
Camp?
Never did a Jewish camp, never did a sleepaway camp.
Yeah.
I mean, on the topic of camps, one of the most important aspects of my entire life and an entire section of Madison Square Garden last night was friends from a summer program I did growing up called Love Well, which I will sing the praises of forever because it changed who I am as a collaborator and a writer.
Hmm.
It's an incredibly unique program that children work alongside an adult staff to create a musical from scratch.
Amazing.
It's 3 weeks of intense writing, choreography, set design, costume, and there's adults in place to help shepherd each of those facets of theater. And then you put on a full production after 3 weeks and cross your fingers that it makes sense.
Yeah.
No, hopefully, you know, usually it does make sense. And it just taught me so much. Every summer I looked forward to doing this as a teenager, and then I teach it every couple summers. I'll be like, I miss it in my life. I miss working with the students. And I'll go to, we have a chapter in Sweden that I go to sometimes.
So it's in multiple locations.
Yeah, it started in Kansas in the 90s. This guy, David Spangler, dreamed it up. I'm very good friends with his children now, and we were students at this program together. He was a musical theater composer. He had a show on Broadway in the 70s, and then he just dreamed this like kind of interdisciplinary students and staff working together to make a show. And yeah, like I said, an entire section at MSG last night was my friends and my old staff and all these people from Lovewell that are still a part of my life.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Maybe your first collaborative team creativity experience that in many ways prepared you perfectly for this Wolf life of
you're,
yours.
You're totally right. It's like all I could talk about last night with the Lovewell friends was like, you guys, I'm basically doing Lovewell with this like indie band called Wolfpack right now. Like that's, you know, and half of this new record, Clarity of Cal, was the product of something like Lovewell, where we went to Theo's ranch in Michigan and me, Joey, Theo, and Jack kind of just wrote a few tunes together in a week of just hanging out, eating food, camping.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think group writing is so cool to me. It's so important.
So as I said earlier, you know, I saw you go in with Jack early on, and I thought of you as a kind of a surrealist performance artist aspect that was being introduced to the band. Like that's how I first saw you.
Sure.
Like you are not ashamed to or afraid of embodying a sort of caricature or taking on a persona when you sing sometimes. Literally, sometimes you'll dial up a pseudo-British thing in your voice or a California thing. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do. I think the British thing is innate because the religion in my house was far more Beatles than it was Jewish.
Yeah.
Like my mom was peppering us with Beatles music, trivia, paraphernalia. You know, it was just nonstop. And thankfully, I'm not mad about it.
Yeah, of course.
But I think the British thing is literally
like how you learned to sing was
it's like almost how I learned to talk and how I learned to communicate. And I was the kid in elementary school who wore a Beatles shirt to school every day.
Yeah.
Like a different Beatles shirt.
Yeah.
And then middle school too and high school too, I think. But did
you take sides? Paul or John?
It fluctuated. I go through phases, and especially when I listen to their solo career musical exports, it's like all of their
records. By the way, you gotta stop doing it. You're too old for this. You can't sit on a wallet, man.
No, I know. What
you'll
the
hurt
heck?
Yourself,
I just pulled a wallet out of my ass.
A big, thick wallet out of the back pocket.
I don't need half of these. I don't need any of this.
Yeah.
Why do we even have a wallet?
I know.
I should have a...
You have what you need in the back of the phone case right there. I can see you've got a credit card in the back of the phone case.
Why do I
But I did not see that coming. You just lifted up the tush and pulled out just like a cigarette pack-sized thing.
What if, you know, where were we? Oh, yeah, no, take a side. Yeah. Nah, dude, I mean, the Beatles were life.
So some of the British...
I think it's...
Affectations, not an affectation, it's like the natural...
I think it's like how I say words. I was actually listening... back to some of my most recent record that me and Theo did with a couple of our friends. And I was like, why am I saying this word this way? I'm not even pronouncing the R in...
What are you thinking of specifically?
Shark smell? Like, I'm not saying shark smells fear. In the song, You Got the Right Idea, I'm like, I'm not singing like, if a shark smells, I'm like, shark. Sometimes I'll go like, shark smells fear. And I'm like, why am I singing it like that? It's like, well, that's how John was singing it.
Yeah.
Or so Paul. So like, I'm... probably just doing it because they did it.
If a shark smells fear, well, don't swim afraid. You got the right idea. Yeah, you got the right idea.
Well, I hear in general, I spent the last couple of days with that record and I really love it.
Thank you.
Was particularly struck at first by the sincerity and heartfelt intimacy of it and vulnerability of it. If you go all in on stage, and I've seen you do it on stage too, this is like so, sometimes you're almost whispering. I've seen some of the videos. There's a one tune, Steady, where you're like lying, sing it almost reclining.
Yeah.
And it's like the microphone almost has to be inside your mouth to catch how soft you're singing.
Yeah.
And it's such an extreme from the, you know, that balls to the wall thing that you're talking about.
Yeah.
I like how you catch me right when I'm crossing the line. When I forget what's offensive and I'm spilling expensive wine. You sound the alarm. Make up some word and scream it. Take every eye of the party off of this idiot. Okay, so it never goes as smooth as we'd like. But when I'm airborne, evil Knievel, you steady the bike.
So I was a little surprised, lyrically, aesthetically, all of that.
I think I grew up wanting to be a Beatle, yeah. Like crying, why won't they, why can't they be alive now? Why can't I be in that band? You know, just mourning the concept of time and not being invited to be a Beatle. But so that's always, that's always been there. I mean, growing up on them and Paul Simon, James Taylor, a little bit of Dylan, just these troubadours singing a story, that was always there. Enter musical theater in middle school, and I'm, you know, cast in You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, and Into the Woods, and I'm like, oh, these are stories, but like stories. These are like, this isn't just like
3 minutes.
This is like an hour and a half story with a bunch of songs. I like this. And then it's high school, and then I'm in theater, and then I'm winning these like theater competitions in this for in the state of Florida, and it's like I won this like best male vocalist thing in high school. And And then I kind of was faced with this thing. I was like, do I go the theater route? Do I try to go to college for theater? Because Lovewell was a part of my summers, like I mentioned. And but I always liked being this like kind of stoner bro rock guy too. And I was like, well, what do I... And I think that's the duality that has been my whole life. And maybe what shocked you at first was like, whoa, he can sing How Much Do You Love Me? And then whisper steady in a tiny room with these guys.
How much do you love me?
I think that's what I've leaned into recently. I've tussled with the what am I thing, like I'm sure a lot of people do. But I'm kind of done asking for permission from audiences to decide which one I am going to be, because I'm all of that. I can sing How Much Do You Love Me in whatever voice I want, and then my heart song can be my heart song, and I can write a song about watching my niece grow up and the sentimental flavors that that has, you know, will be there. And I think funny is funny, sad is sad. Sometimes they are in bed together, sometimes, you know, they're not, and that's just life. That that we all have this. I think some people are just afraid to embrace the fact that we have all of those feelings inside of us.
I mean, I think also it helps to put some boundary around the work. I certainly feel from Theo that he is really reaching for what I feel as a very personal truth every time. From you, what I feel is sometimes and sometimes I made this shit up. And it's the same guy singing it. So it gave me a certain sense after listening, because I'm always asking myself, is this, is he writing about his life or not? Is he telling me something about himself or is he not? And then finally I was like, I don't think it matters. I mean, he's telling me something about himself because he wrote it. So that's what he's telling me. Whether or not he lived it doesn't matter.
That's a great point. I think it's emergent regardless. And I think for my new record, there's a song called 18 Wheels to Texas. It's a story. It's a journey. It's just a journey. And it, I, my intention was to keep it vague.
Judging by the tops of trees, we're moving again. Faster than my friend, so lay your head on my knee. In the still of the night, in the chill of the breeze.
I've never been in the back of a flatbed truck or the back of a semi truck hiding behind produce so that the guard czar at the border doesn't find me. I've never been in that position. I don't really know exactly what that feels like, but I've definitely been somewhere I'm not supposed to. I've definitely like felt like I was, hitchhiking with people I didn't really know.
Yeah.
Like, or that's a story. I'm allowed to fictionalize that. And as long as it's coming, like you said, from a real place,
yeah.
which is my heart and my mind, then I think it's allowed.
And sound, too. I mean, I think you also reveal a lot about yourself in the way rhymes work with you and sounds. There's the one tune, what is it, the last tune on the record?
Chickarondale.
Right, which is definitely, is just, it seems to me, like fun with sound.
We wrote it, dude. We wrote it one night. So the recording process of You Got the Right Idea was like Theo's other records and 10 Good Songs, you know.
Demo,
The label world. It's a couple songs a day. Spaghetti and wine at night, wake up the next morning and do it again. It's the most beautiful way I've ever had the privilege of making anything with a band. And
it's basics live, like trying to get as much live as possible.
Yeah, and honestly, trying to keep the overdubs to such a minimum that you barely need a day to hit stuff if you need to overdub anything. Or not,
a vocal double here and there.
A vocal double, an extra slide sound into a chorus. No retakes. Yeah. I'm not redoing, I'm not going to re-sing verse two from this tune. Yeah. And we're not going to recut the guitar because it was all a lot of hot mics in one room.
Yep.
So we're not going to do anything crazy. Anyways, Chickarondale was one night with a bottle of red wine. And I think we just kept, I kept saying Chickarondale. Like there was, Theo's neighbor was this guy named Dale. Someone, I think our engineer and his wife were staying at his cabin. Nick and his wife were at Dale's cabin. It was like Chickarondale. We just kept saying, and we didn't know, is it Chickarondale? Is it Chicker on Dale Street? Is it, what is this? And we're like, it doesn't matter. We're just singing. And we all started singing. We wrote a song one night. And at the very end of the week, we were like, should we track that song we wrote a couple nights ago, Chickarondale? And I'm like, it's a shame if, someone said it's a shame if we don't. Yeah. I think Nick, our audio engineer, was like, we have to. And we did it all around one mic. And it was just, it was such a fun thing. And yeah, I think it's going to be a lot of people's favorite on the record.
Help me out, Chickarondale. Help me out, Chickarondale. Help me out before I go to jail. Help me out, Chickarondale. Running out of Zinfandel. Running out of Zinfandel.
Well, what I think is funny about it is it's like you've gone through this collection of songs that feel honest and feel vulnerable and feel revelatory in some way. And then you end with this thing, which again is like me realizing they're not taking themselves too seriously. Mm-hmm. They're doing it seriously. They're playing it beautifully. But if there's a rule, they broke it with this song. And so don't be so precious about things. Like, even as a listener, don't be so precious about what you're listening to.
Yeah, and like you said earlier, which I like, it's like I think there's a natural, it's an impulse by the listener to place anything they see or hear into a box.
Yes.
Or rank it.
Yes.
Like, this is the best thing I've ever heard. This is the, I hate this. Oh, this sounds a lot like XYZ.
Yeah.
I think we are all the product of what we've ingested over time. And Chickarondale is like this lost Beatles song. It's like Bungalow Bill, but it's like
Rocky Raccoon.
It's like, what is it? It's a story about a guy. He needs help not going to jail. Like, what's help me? Al Chickarondale. It's like a guy, he's running out of white Zinfandel, but it's, I don't, what's going on? It doesn't matter. You know, it's like we've already sung the What Matters songs. Yeah. Like the song about Jacob's niece, the song about, you know, but moving on, that song without him, about moving on from a bad relationship.
You can leave your life. Dryer for a week. Try a yoga class, segue to pottery. Take a long ass bath, crank that heat. Baby, you can keep it all when you win the lottery.
What is one seat down?
One seat down's the one about my niece. About,
you feel she's pushing away from you?
No, I think it's just about watching something you love, someone you love, find themselves and grow up. And I actually got that idea. I was at the movies with my niece, my best friends, and their two kids, one of which is my godson. Mm-hmm. And so these are like my favorite.
Yeah, kids.
Babies in my life. Yeah. These are my kids. And the movie's about to start, and one of them turns, and they're like, Mommy, we're going to go sit over there. It was an empty theater, and they just go, they sit at the end of the row we're in. And I'm like, I look down, and I'm like, oh, damn. I'm like, where did the kids go? And then they're like, at the end. And I'm like, whoa. And then like during the movie, I basically was thinking like, is that what life is? Like kids just scooting one seat down every year to like their own independence? Like, man, that like feeling that parents must have when the kid goes to college is so real. That's so heavy. Like they're about to become their own literal decision maker, and you don't have a thing to do with their everyday life now. And so the one
seat, most likely they're not going to tell you. There's a thing, you know, there's things they're not going to tell you.
And it's just trust at this point. It's like, did I raise the, and I'm sure as a parent yourself, you're like, I think I'm doing this right. I'm instilling everything I think is the right move to make.
Yes.
And I hope they actually follow through with this, with, I guess, the right decisions.
Yeah.
So the one seat down concept is just about watching or feeling someone you love grow as they march a little closer towards independence every day.
Nobody said it was a fair fight. Swan diving in a circus pond. You thought we died every night to be born again at dawn. I watched your smile change. Magnets on a fridge door. Chalk dust and finger paint. Your bike's rusting on the porch.
It's so funny that you're like, people want to compare things and place it. And at the same time, you say we are all a collection of our influences and the things that we love. And we filter them through ourselves and our experience and our bodies and whatever. And it comes out as us. Because listening to your songs also, I think, like you play with the language of pop music in all these different ways. And sometimes I'm like, oh, this is feeling very... like reminding me of Girl, You'll Be a Woman. And this is reminding me of Manic Monday. And this is reminding me of, like, I'm hearing things that are in the air that we grow up with and that we sort of recontextualize and borrow from. You know what I mean?
I think part of that is like knowing a lot of stuff.
Songs?
Yeah. I think I just have learned a lot of songs for wedding gigs and stuff. You know, blue collar musician brain a little bit. And then I will always write something and be like, oh, wait, that's literally this thing.
Right.
Oh, God, that's the exact melody of... Girl, You'll Be a Woman sooner. I don't know. Yellow Submarine, whatever the hell. It's like, I think knowing how to deviate a little bit but keep it familiar is the name of the game.
Yeah.
I think it's at least what comes naturally to me. An example being the Wolf tune, This Is Not the Song I Wrote.
Yeah. That's incredible. Wait, so I want to talk about this song. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
But tell me what you were going to say.
Well, I was just going to say, that could be... I'd be surprised if there wasn't a melody like that already somewhere on the internet, like a note or two off, because it's so simple and pentatonic. But like, can you like look around the room and you're like, can you guys place that? Can you, wait, is that,
well,
have
that's
you guys
the,
heard
no,
that
that's
before?
The job. That's clearly the job. I mean, the
yeah,
job,
that's the job of that tune for sure.
Well, of that tune. But in general, as you're saying, is like, speak the language,
right.
Say something new.
Right.
And that's how I feel listening to your record. It's like, I can hear that you are speaking this language of songwriting, of Paul Simon, of the Beatles, of James Taylor, of reggae, of like, I can just hear things that are in there. As opposed to This Is Not the Song I Wrote, again, you talk about like a meta lyric and a meta song, a song about what it is. I mean, as I understand it, it is a song from the point of view of a sort of Michael McDonald-ish character whose song has been interpolated in a pop context and it's successful, and he's pissed because his song was minor, it's been placed major, his song had all these changes, they just basically took some little aspect of his melody and put it in this ridiculous package. And he goes, it sucks, this isn't what I wrote. He tries to sue the lawyers, whatever, then he realizes that the song is doing well, and he embraces it, and like the lyric doesn't make any sense, and he keeps going, this doesn't make sense what you're saying or my song.
But the views keep climbing, going
song I wrote. And then finally, even he and all of us who have made it through the 3 minutes of this song have to come to terms with the fact that it is a strong hook.
Well, like, that is the come to terms and the made it through, those terms you just used.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
I was bitten before I could finally see. This whole snafu renewed my popularity. Endless chains of emails. We worked out the details. Now it's synced at retail. The check is in the mail. So now I'm singing, going, ayo, everybody going, ayo. Move that body, going up, up, up in slow. Going down, 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 let's go. Ayo, everybody going, ayo. Move that body, going up, up, up in slow. Guess this is the song we wrote.
I mean, sometimes to me, that's what pop music is. It's like, dang, that thing stuck in my head. I didn't like it at first.
Yes.
And it, God dang it, it's in my head. It must, you kind of like rationalize with yourself. Like, okay, I guess it's good. It's in my head and I actually want to hear it again. But that song is so unique because I think I'm almost positive I'm telling the truth when I say it was a reincarnated idea, the minor verse concept. And the melody was an old Wolf idea, I think, in the graveyard from pre my existence. In Wolf.
Got it.
And that kind of resurfaced during this writing weekend we had at Theo's ranch for the Clarity of Cal record. This is the product of me feeling free.
Yes.
And Jack is such a shepherd and an incredible friend when it comes to letting me be me. And I have, I mean, maybe one day it'll be diagnosed as some form of Tourette's or something, but I will just blurt out melodies and words and... a percentage of the time, Jack will sing it back to me, or he'll yell it like, yes, yes, that. And I'm like, really? That thing you like?
Everybody does Jack in Jack voice, by the way.
Yeah, that. Jack, I mean, Jack's the best, man. And that was the result of me in Theo's kitchen one morning. Everybody's kind of making coffee and getting ready. Or actually, it might have been lunchtime, but I was going, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Going up, up, up in smoke. I had up, up, up in smoke. Going down, 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 let's go. And I was doing it like my, you know, my Miami friends, you know, like some, like, I don't know, Pitbull, Daddy Yankee thing. I was like, let's go, you know. And
what is that? That's something. That's like evocative of something.
It's like, it's honestly this, I don't, in my head, it's this scene I grew up in. It's this like, bailamos, like this like my Miami friends doing the Miami scene thing, which I loved. And I'm a part of in my heart and it's in my blood, you know. But I don't know, man. I was just singing that and then they reincarnated this verse. And then I think we were thinking of that, like,
let me tell you.
Remember there was this, you're my little boo thing.
Yeah.
So I'll give a hoot what you do say, girl. I know you a little too tame. I'll be shooting that shot like 2K.
That, like,
that's done over the what track is that?
I forget, man. I'm just... dun, dun,
dun, yes. Dun, 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 yeah, what? I can't remember.
But there was this like settlement that had to be made over that or something. And we were like, let's parody that. Yeah. Let's just like write the tune that is that story almost.
It's amazing.
It kind of worked itself out in a funny way.
It's so amazing and it's taking it... I mean... going all the way back to 1612, which is a song about trying to remember how to write a song or coming up with a code to your heart. That's what it is.
Yeah, that's code in my heart. I don't know the exact story, but it might have been like a code that they needed to remember for an Airbnb or something, or I don't
but
know.
But when I talked to Jack years ago, and he told me that it's a song about songwriting somehow.
Oh, dang, that's cool.
Now, I know zero people have picked up on this, but... it was like, it was the idea that you go to a songwriting class and they say, you know, actually being specific is cooler than being vague. So then the idea is like, I'm the student and took that a little too seriously, you know? I actually give you the code to my heart. Like, you might hear a Motown song about the code to my heart, but now he's gonna give you the number to the kids.
That's the idea.
Yeah, so.
It's a sentence. What you need to say. Sometimes I write a little song so you don't forget it. Sometimes I write a little song to remember the lyrics. I go 12. That's a code to my heart. I go 1 6 1 2. Star.
You had this sort of early period of your career that was the Jacob Jeffries Band.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I was kind of obsessed with becoming like a Dave Matthews Band.
Yeah.
Style, festy circuit, kind of. I had a best friend, still talk to all the time, but a guitar player. He's since moved to Vegas, has a family there, works in the music scene in Vegas. Yeah. But he was, to this day, he's probably my favorite slide guitar player. I mean, he sounds like Trucks, and he's like Trucks and Walsh.
Yeah, cool.
His name's Jimmy Powers, and he's Jimmy Powers the Fifth.
Ooh, whoa.
Yeah, strong.
Whoa, it's very strong.
Too strong. He was so, it was basically him and I. Like some version of Lennon and McCartney in my mind, where maybe I was doing a bulk of the writing, but like he was doing a bulk of the like musical lift, because he was so talented. He is so talented on guitar.
You got everything wrong, all wrong. You can't stop the bleeding with a song. But you can cross your fingers again and again and make the same mistake once you shed your skin.
And then when we started going separate ways we tried to live in New York, but we couldn't, it was hard money-wise to survive, and he had to move back to Florida, and we kind of just lost touch a little bit, and I realized maybe the band thing, I'm going to have different iterations of a band.
Yeah.
I use air quotes because what is a band? So I ended up scrubbing, I guess, the name Jacob Jeffries Band.
Did you make a record at Full Sail with Sebastian Criss?
Yes. Do you know Sebastian?
I'm aware of him, his work, for sure. And
he was my producer in Miami, him and Dan Warner, who I dedicate all my music to. And Dan passed away suddenly right before the pandemic, man, 2019 maybe. Mm-hmm. I was in Europe when it happened, but him and Sebastian produced my first two or three EPs and LP, and they're just Miami music legends.
Yeah.
Sebastian had arranged for us to make a live record at Full Sail using their film and TV personnel and students. And
because I didn't know this. He went to Full Sail.
He had, a stint there. I don't know if he did the whole, I don't know what Full Sail's full.
It's only 2 years, I think.
I think
probably.
It's 2 years, okay.
Yeah.
I think Sebastian did go there, He called in some favors and connected some dots, and we were able to make a record there when I was about 20, 21. And I'm not, I think people are supposed to grow, and they're supposed to go through stages in life. I think Sting did an interview once where he was like, I'm not playing, when he was going solo and doing tours, he's like, I'm not playing the Police tunes.
Yeah.
It's from another world, another life. But then he realized, like, oh my God, they won't stop chanting, you know, like Roxanne or whatever. Like, they need me to play this. And it's like, oh wait, that was a part of my musical journey. That's actually part of who I am. That's chapter, you know,
one,
that's chapter,
or whatever. Yeah.
I mean, it's part of your novel. Yeah. So it's like, I mean, my story isn't my story without these records that, look, I was learning how to voice my opinion in the studio, how to make my sound happen. So I was 18, 19, 20 years old being shepherded by Grammy Award winning producers, and what they felt sounded great, I was like, oh yeah, for sure. And then I think it helped sculpt how I act in a studio, how I voice my opinion, how I get a sound, how I trust, how I communicate. And they're so instrumental, Sebastian and Dan, in my career. And being 18 and working with Grammy Award winning legends from mainly in the Latin community, music scene, but also, you know, Dan, I mean, Warner played on Timberlake and Madonna records. I was blessed early on to meet these cats as a kid, pretty much. I think that Sebastian isn't the only person in the music industry that has an opinion, obviously.
Yeah.
And he is unafraid to share that. And I was so grateful that I was dealt that sense of strong. Yeah. These dudes, man, I lost my dad when I was 19.
Yeah.
These dudes kind of stepped in as my dads who were also my producers, who were also like my label, because they bankrolled all the musicians to come play on it. They got me my publishing deal at Warner Chappell when I was 18. They took me to New York to do these meetings. They helped. I met Rick Rubin when I was 19 in LA. Cow. Like, they did these things to me that felt kind of like big wiggy. And then I would go in the studio with them and I'd be like, whatever you guys say.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for everything. I wouldn't be here without you. And you guys are geniuses. Yeah. And they are. It's not to say they aren't.
Yeah.
You have your own version in your mind. And sometimes you're either afraid to voice your opinion or you don't even know what you want it to sound like. Yeah. You're like, and you can't blame yourself for trusting someone who cares about you, who's been in the industry for longer than you, and who is showing you enough belief that they have such a strong opinion.
That's a super deep thing. And I've been thinking about that also, how seductive it is when you play something for somebody and they care enough to have an opinion. Because, of course, apathy is like what we're mostly met with is people that just are not paying attention.
Well, because there's like a selfishness that is hard to get through, especially in the art world, where when someone dedicates their day, when you're, dude, you're dedicating an hour, 2 hours of your day to me right now to like hear my story. Like, that is such a selfless, cool, egoless, in a world of spotlight on me, give me the mic land. Like, that's so cool of you. And like, it's very cool of Sebastian to be like, I'm gonna pour $50,000 and 5 months of my life into like helping your career. It's like, thank you.
Yeah. What do you think?
Yeah. Whatever you think.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's, you know, fast forward a million years, here we are. And Theo,
yeah,
who I can say is my best friend and favorite collaborator and just such a great person, man. And he opens the doors to his own home and his own gear and his own, and his brain becomes your brain for a week, making your record. He eats, sleeps, drinks your record with you. And you're, I mean, it's, there's no greater feeling than to have a co-pilot like that.
Yeah, that is amazing.
It's so cool, man.
The greatest thing that we can give people is our attention.
Yeah.
In our headspace, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm so envious of that. I have to say I'm so envious. I have a lot of, as we all do, I have a lot of distraction in my life that makes the idea of surrendering fully to any one project so seductive to me.
To be able to put life on hold and do a project, you mean? I know, and I think the untethering is the hard part. What made the record making process at Theo's Ranch so unique was the untethering. Was I kind of wrote about this in my Substack, but it's like you're not asking, what do you guys want for dinner? Oh, sorry, I got a break early, I have a date down the street, like,
or I have a gig tonight.
Yeah, or I have a gig tonight. Yeah. Or you're in 40 acres of wilderness. Yeah. Like, and the closest gas station is a 15-minute drive away. You're not going anywhere tonight. Yeah. You're here, you're working on this record until dinner, and then we're
hanging
out. Yeah, that is a beautiful, it's a privilege, and it's a beautiful thing.
It's also the culmination of a lot of choices and things that he didn't choose in his life that set him up for that situation.
I mean, we're going deep. That's what the point of this is. Yeah. I have my best friend is my sister, truly. I know I said it was Theo, but
You can have more than, I've learned from my teenage daughter.
I have so many.
You can accommodate more than one best friend.
I have a lot, man. My sister and I were dealt crazy, tragic hands early. We lost our dad when I was 19. She was only 17. Mm. And then our mom died 5 years later.
Oh, I didn't know that. I'm sorry.
It's okay. She had cancer and I was just late to figuring it out because we were dealing with our dad just suddenly died and we had to get out of the house and it was a crazy time, man. It was very heavy. I've grown a lot since then. It was so many years ago and my sister and I just decided, I think, for what we needed out of life, I guess, to go completely opposite directions. My sister ended up marrying her safe person, her high school sweetheart, and they had spent years apart, but then when our mom got sick, I think she ran to someone that made her feel safe and seen and that she could trust. Mm. And they had a kid. My sister decided after my mom got sick to become a nurse. Mm. She is now a nurse for over a decade. Now she's a pediatric nurse in LA. Mm. And although my sister has a better voice than anybody I know, she didn't follow music. She went that way and went life and has house and has dogs and has kid. And I went that way. I went nothing. I got a tiny dog, but.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. And then he thankfully can stay at my sister's when I'm out of town. But I don't have these things that would effectively in the real world tether me too much, allowing me to kind of travel and to go to the woods and make a record.
Yeah.
And I kind of envy my sister's life. I've told it's the grass is greener.
Always.
It's the, you know, I love my, I can see the stability in coming home to a husband and a kid and a just that set of fundamental traditions and fundamental
structure,
stability and structure. Yeah. Like you said, choices have been made over the years for Theo, for myself.
Yes.
That can help shape a deep dive for a week into a body of music.
And make room for the work. Make room for the art. Not that you don't have room otherwise, but I look at the life that you describe and I think, you know, one way of framing it is everything is basically set up to accommodate this work that I'm going to do and this music that I'm going to make.
Dude, I have a hard time booking a flight for a quote-unquote vacation.
Right, yeah.
I'm like, I have to do something musical here.
Yeah.
Because, like, I have to, it's what I do.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I'm not going, we went to Japan to play with Wolf, and then I extended the vacation, quote-unquote. But when I went to Korea after, but I'm like, I have to work with someone here. So, like, I
you booked something.
I had to. Yeah. I had to connect the dots and meet a producer. I had to meet a writer. I wanted to write. I wanted to meet people. And it's like, that is the beauty of the cliche, like, make your work your passion.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
It's like,
do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life.
There you go. That's it.
Yeah.
That's the hang in there poster.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I think that's part of I've been able to do this professionally for a long time. And I think it's because of choices I made and because of people, truly because of people that have believed in me and pushed me along the way and helped me. One of my old roommates from New York, a good friend of mine, he was at Madison Square Garden last night. And he said to me, he looked me in the eyes, he was welling up and I think he was emotional. And he goes, brother, he's like, I feel like a proud brother.
Yeah.
I remember schlepping your keyboard to Rockwood. We would carry it in and we'd have to carry it back all the way up to 95th Street and First Avenue.
Yeah. Oh.
And he's like, yeah, I mean, subways and stuff, but we had your keyboard, you know? And he's like, here you are. He's like, I know how hard you've been going at this thing.
You know, you described briefly, you know, being taken to meet Rick Rubin and getting the deal and all that stuff, which is in the moment, it must have felt like you were just 6 inches away from Madison Square Garden.
Yeah.
And it turns out you were 20 years away from Madison Square Garden.
Well, I think when you're young and you're presented, I was 18 years old and presented with a publishing deal that had a $25,000 signing bonus attached to it. And to a kid, $25,000 felt like $1.5 million.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah.
It had
this
like weird dreamy inflation to it in the mind.
Yeah.
And I was like, I made the decision at that point. I was like, I'm not going to college.
Yeah.
I'm buying a car. And I'm touring. It's funny how you can feel so big and then be dealt reality.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, getting flown out to Palm Springs with my mom, I remember, to go meet Rick Rubin at this event. It's like, I'll remember that forever. It's such a formative touchstone in my life.
Yeah.
Rick Rubin will have no idea who I am ever. He will not remember this. But, like, it was so huge for me.
Yes.
Yeah, man, that's part of the thing, man. We all have such deeply woven stories of highs and lows. That's so beautiful.
Yeah.
It's the humanity of it all.
That's the humanity of it all. Jacob Jeffries, thank you for sharing some of the humanity with me today.
Mm.
Such a pleasure to meet you and hang.
What an honor, dude. I love your work. I love your place. You're so kind, and I thank you for letting me talk for a little bit.
Drink enough until you can't stand.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.